So we're 2.4.6, second ring, inviting vitality, inviting that nine-year-old to awaken. Southwest Shield, the dropping in. And then the Northwest Strand, the cultural elements, the things that are in the body of the people, in the energy of the field of the people. And so this is what we're looking at right now. We're going into something that essentially, in and of itself, supports connection modeling at the highest level. And it's called wandering. And you can substitute timelessness also into it. And a lot of modern practitioners who are realizing that people's modern days are carved up into ever-diminishing blocks of time. And that, you know, one of the biggest barriers to connection in modern times is exactly that. You know, children are overscheduled. They're highly programmed. They go from this to that, to this to that. And moms and dads today complain that basically they're taxi services for their children, and they feel like each child needs a personal assistant. So it seems virtually impossible to initiate timelessness in a time-measured reality. I really wish that I captured this on film, but I didn't. But it's forever etched in my consciousness. You may have the same idiosyncratic thing that I have, if you might recognize this in your own life, but now, you know, I have an iPhone, so I grab it and I look at it to see what time it is. So I turn it on for a second, and then I put it in my pocket. And then someone will say to me seconds later, "What time is it?" I can't remember. And I don't remember. And I'll have to pull it out and do it again. "Well, didn't you just look at what time it was?" "Yeah, I did, but I don't remember." And that's really, like, we do that. I don't know why we do that. But so we feel compelled to look, and then we forget a second later. So what's the point? But I don't know. We do it anyway. And I definitely do that. But before the iPhone, I had a carabiner watch that I got at REI, which I thought was really cool, you know, because you could kind of flip it up and look at it, and then someone would ask you what time it was, and then you'd have to look at it again, right? Same thing. But it was this little green plastic thing, and it clipped on, and you could turn the little face and flip it, so you could use it upside down or right side up. I don't know why that mattered, but it worked. And so I had this thing in the Kalahari. And it was right when I met Hanuma, the old holy man who passed away a couple summers ago. And this man has known nothing in his entire life, 90 years of walking on the earth barefoot in the Kalahari, than the ways of his people. You know, and he had the initiation tattoos across his chest. You know, he was basically considered unemployable, but people liked him. So he hung around and was fed and taken care of because they respected him and loved his knowledge, but he was also a healer, and he was able to heal people in this really profound way through something called the trance dance, which is their main healing ceremony. Hanuma had tremendous knowledge, needless to say. I mean, he was a bushman, so I don't need to go into the details, but this guy really, really knew a lot about plants, and he was always teaching us things. I mean, even you'd think with his advanced age that he wasn't going to be able to tie things and be refined with his fingers, but he was making cordage for us and showing us how to do it. Then he was making traps like snares and showing us how to set them. And, you know, this guy really knew what he was doing. And he was just thoroughly, fully a bushman. When his people were relocated, they were actually forcibly taken from their homeland and moved to a settlement because their homeland became a national park. So they were removed from it. Instead of going to the settlement, he ran into the bush and just lived wild on the edge of civilization so that he couldn't be seen or detected. And he was one of the people that actually literally had to avoid being seen and during his lifetime because they were highly persecuted, even hunted, you know. So any sound that reminded him a truck was coming or any indication that people were coming, he would disappear. And he was showing us how you have to run and leap over the road so you don't leave footprints across it, you know, and you do it where the bushes grow close to the road. So he was teaching us all his counter-tracking techniques. and laughing the whole time while he was doing it. Everyone was laughing, watching him running and leaping across the road. And his wife would run right behind him and she would leap too, you know, and it was great. But it kind of gave you insight into what these people had to do to survive, right? So I didn't really know him very well, you know, kind of met him, because you meet all of them when you get there, because everyone has to meet everyone. And he saw me do that. He saw me lift up my carabiner watch and look at it and drop it. He didn't ask me what time it was, but he said something to me in Bushman, and the translator, Nyilki, she starts laughing. And she says, John, Hanuman wants to know if that's a timepiece. And I look at him, he's looking at me with these very disapproving eyes, you know, like, you didn't have to speak Bushman to know that he wasn't happy with me for that one. And I said, yes, it is. And then I started to realize how ridiculous. I'm in the Kalahari. And I looked at my timepiece. And he says, like this, we don't like these things, he says in his language. And she says, he says he's not, he doesn't like it. And I said, why? And she says, asks him, and he says, because every time one of you looks at one of those, the next thing you do is rude. Yeah, just let that settle in, right? Like relive your whole life. And when we're talking about connection modeling, and I love that the church bell's ringing while we're doing this is so perfect. We're talking about connection modeling, and connection, literally, the brain requires a sense of timelessness for the nervous system to enact whatever it's going to do next that furthers connection. So, you know, remember in the research, children all over the world, as soon as they can, when they're given the leave to do so, get out of sight of the parents and find a place where the parents can't see them. They may not go very far away, but they're going to conceal themselves because they know that something in the actions of others will shortchange their need for timelessness. And they don't know that rationally. They know it in an embodied way. So timelessness is clearly important for our developing, expanding neurology and in support of that instinctive longing to get connected. We need timelessness. You know, to further accentuate that story, you know, what Hanuma said was, we know you have Monday. He says, but that doesn't belong to us. You made that up somewhere else and then you brought it here, but it's not our problem. We see it like a sickness, that you impose these measured things over time. We don't know when we're born. We don't have birth certificates. We don't have months. We don't know Monday. We don't know Tuesday. It's not ours, right? That's yours. Please don't put it on us. And that really caused me to step back and look at the things that we all take for granted, these structural elements that move within our world. And within some traditions, I'm sure it's healthy. Like Shabbat, I really celebrate that. There's a good reason, because you're literally setting up a time for timelessness, right? You're giving a whole 25 hours to it. That's a gift. That's clearly a gift. What happened to the Gregorian calendar and what happened with measured time, they fused together and they became an overlay over the economic, political reality that we all live under. And then law got tied into it also. So in a certain sense, we are quite literally enslaved by something that's bad for our connection system. But it's not looked at in that way. As a matter of fact, if you're not doing this, then there's something wrong with you. You know, Richard Louv speaks about barriers to connection. And, you know, to be fair to him, he says, I'd rather not talk about barriers. I'd rather talk about the successes, because there's some real successes happening in the connection world. So let's not focus on the barriers. But at the same time, he's completely in agreement that if you are a designer of social systems for positive change and you don't design with the barriers in mind, your designs won't be very valuable. You know, Luby McNamara, the permaculture, social permaculturist from the UK, she speaks to that directly. She's like, any designer who's not designing with limits, challenges, and barriers in mind, their designs are not very useful. So in our time, we know we're inheriting a bunch of unconscious incompetence. We know we are. If we don't step back and look to see what kind of barriers are being set up by that, then what we're passing down might be the same. Okay, that's my warning about this. And with timelessness, we have to be really thoughtful because neurobiologically, we need it. We need it. But structurally, economically, politically, socially, we're not afforded that. We're not given that gift, that right, whatever you want to call it. So I'm super glad that within the community, Shabbat is important because there's an agreement, a social contract with all of you that you're going to set time aside for timelessness. And that's gorgeous, right? But what if you made mini Shabbats all throughout the week? What if you could take timelessness and offer it to others in small units? And you can. And this is what modern practitioners are figuring out, because it's only about perception on the part of the receiver. They only have to perceive timelessness. And you, the practitioner, the facilitator of the moment of timelessness, know that it's only going to last an hour, which is ironic. But you're holding the consciousness of time to give the person you're working with the illusion of timelessness, and it works. We're finding that that works. So I'm going to say that right now. We don't have to abolish Monday, although I'm sure many of us wouldn't mind. No. The 9-to-5 thing is actually being challenged right now by really high-level organizational thinkers and productivity analysts and all these people at MIT. And, you know, they're all kind of looking at it and they're like, well, actually, 9-to-5 makes no sense at all. It doesn't actually deliver productivity. It actually works against productivity. And they have there's companies now that are actually looking at ways to support people's natural flow of creativity and productivity and looking at cycling, you know, including timelessness in the cycling. So, you know, I'm thankful that there's modern thinkers that are recognizing the value of connection, you know. And that it's actually influencing things at high level management and shifting corporate culture even. So that's a hopeful thing. But going back to barriers to connection for just a moment and saying one of the barriers of connection, you know, the number one is fear on the part, especially of parents. They're afraid to let their children be unsupervised outside because of all the things that might happen to them. And a lot of that is driven potentially by media news that is now constant. So if something happens in Oklahoma to a child outside because of a kidnapping or something like that, you hear it 5-10 times a day through all these different news feeds, you think it happened next door. And so that drives a fear cycle. But this hasn't been proven, but this is a suggestion. You know, maybe that's why there's so much fear on the part of parents and they won't let their kids out of their sight. But that is the number one barrier to nature connection in children today. The parents are afraid. The second one is access to nature, to wild nature. The third one is related to timelessness. And it has to do with social stigma. So if you, as a parent, raise your children to be barefoot tree climbers who are timeless and unsupervised because you're nurturing their connection, other parents will look down their nose at you. They call it the criminalization of free play, in quotes. There's a social stigma. Like, is an agreed upon, accepted ethic that isn't even backed by research. It doesn't even have validity, but there has great social momentum. So when I run connection-based workshops, and I allow the people to arrive and visit with each other in a timeless way until I feel like it's time to start. I'm literally doing that. There's people who came and paid for the workshop who are doing this and then looking at me cross. right? And I feel my shame response coming up, and I almost want to call everyone to the circle because someone did that, right? This unspoken language of that criminalization of free play, it harkens back to my own personal wound. When are you going to grow up and join the real world? Which I heard so many times when I was pursuing a connection modeling career. When are you going to grow up and join the real world? You know, I won that argument when I was 19, when I stood my ground and I said with all my personal power to my father, which real world are you talking about? Are you talking about the stars, the sun, the weather, the trees, the birds, the animals? Are you talking about the man-made world? That's like a prison for me, right? I said it with tears and fierceness. And my dad said, you know, Jonathan, I have to say you're right on this one. And he said, but your mother and I are worried about you because how can you make a living? How can you look after your family? That's what we're really worried about. And then he said, and people who speak like you, they end up nailed to a cross in our society. Just look at the history of it. You know, he said, so I worry about you in that way. So it's like the grand stigma, the grand criminalization of free play. It is really literally the conquistadors hunting for the indigenous, wherever that took place. You know, so I'm referencing the land we call Mexico now, but I'm right now reading a book by Mac McCartney from the UK, writing about the exact story when the Romans were hunting for the indigenous people of Albion, which is now called Britain, right? So this is a grand story and a big collision and a huge historic trauma, and it shows up right here in the most bizarre way. Pay attention to that shadowy thing that's happening. When people measure time and then offer you rudeness, when are you going to get in line and be under control? That's the feeling that comes up in the children when they're feeling timelessness. Hmm. They're obeying their original hard wiring. They're obeying their original neurobiology, and they're met with oppressive emotional violence that nobody even knows is that. You know, what does it mean to be rude? It means to cut off connection. And in a culture like the Kalahari Bushmen, this particular community that I'm working with right now, they value connection. They value it. Like it's like a shared ethic, a shared commitment, a shared morality. We owe it to each other to be highly connective at all times. And they put a great emphasis on that, right? By the way, that is not at odds with living well in modern times. What it is at odds with is how we incorporate that challenge, because you're now challenging the historic trauma that's sitting in the room in plain view, the criminalization of free play. What value does wandering have? How are you going to make a living from wandering, right? When Stalking Wolf came around Tom Brown's house, the parents didn't like the influence that Stalking Wolf was having on Tom because he was a homeless drifter. Now that's a great name for hunter-gatherer nomad right there. So look at the stigma. Two different ways of saying the same thing. A homeless drifter, a hunter-gatherer nomad hanging on to his lineage, right? When Tom started hanging around with me, my mother and dad were really worried, and a biographer was interviewing my mom and said, were you worried that Tom was taking your son down the wrong road, you know, that he might be abusive or that he might be giving drugs to your son? Oh, no, 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 none of those things. He's a really fine man, and he took good care of Jonathan, and he loved him. Well, then why were you worried about him? Well, because he was a drifter, a wanderer. He had no purpose, no destination, no plan. So it's, again, I'm just pointing out the stigma that's there around timelessness and what may be boiling up inside of you around this one. But then, looking at all the neurobiological research, it's absolutely clear that we need wandering We need timelessness. We need to know that we have unstructured downtime to explore and be ourselves without supervision, without a plan, without a program. And that's what allows the neurology to unfold. And so, you know, our response to it is that we, you know, artificially stimulate that through something we call the sit spot, right? And the sit spot once was called the secret spot because, according to one author, and we never really were able to fact check this, but we did find other evidence of it in other indigenous communities, that there was encouragement for children to find a place that was secret. That they could, in other words, they could go by themselves without being witnessed with adult judgment. So the grandparents especially did that for the children. And I think that that's just really deep wisdom and understanding. So what we do with modern people is we ask them to adopt a place in nature that they go and sit on a regular basis. And I used to be kind of picky about that. Nowadays, I tell people, go outside your front door and sit on the stoop. Because if you don't, you won't at all. Because if you have to go to the park to find that ideal sit spot, you're probably not going to do it. And routine is necessary. How much regular timelessness can we give ourselves? Can you give yourself 5 minutes of timelessness, or is that ridiculous? I find that it isn't. And maybe it's because I've been doing this for so long, I know how to drop into that place within me where timelessness expands out, right? Like it's like a neuromuscular memory inside me is strong enough that I'm trained enough, essentially, to find even a few seconds of timelessness really helpful. And I watched this in Tom Brown because he's busy teaching one class after the next, week in, week out, day in and day out. And he and I were leaving his house and walking to the barn, and it's about a 15-yard walk or 20-yard walk maybe. And I start heading for the barn, you know, I'm kind of going, we got to go teach this section. I was all excited, you know, and he's like, grabs my shirt. Where are you going? To the barn. He's like, slow down. He says, this is my timelessness. And so he walks in this pace, this really relaxed pace, and he just lets his eyes go to the horizon. And in the, you know, 100 steps it takes to get to the barn, he finds access to that part of himself again. And that really reminded me, you know, the importance of inserting timelessness into our time-filled days, you know. And you know what's cool about that? This is going to sound really, really awful. You can set an alarm on your smartphone for 15 minutes and hit go and stick it in your pocket and then go wander. And wandering is critical because it isn't, I have to get to this place, okay? Wandering activates another part of your neurology because basically, you know, and Tom writes about this in either The Tracker or The Search, but one of his books, there's a chapter called Gentle Wanderings, and it's absolutely brilliant. It hits this so hard. Basically says, you know where you're headed, roughly, but as you walk, you stop and you feel in your body, which way do you feel called? And what's your curiosity telling you? You're literally listening to the body to take you on a journey. So you might have the idea that you're heading that way, but as you're walking, you just get the feeling to stop, and then you look over that way, and you see a beautiful little flower growing at the base of a tree. So you walk over to it, and then you look at it, and then you just kind of look around, and you smell the air, and you feel yourself in your body, and then you're like, huh, I can hear a little creek flowing down there. I never knew that was there. So then you kind of wander over there, and then you look, and you're like, oh, wow, that's so cool. You know, you're actually activating something that 9-year-olds do quite well when they're by themselves. You know, they follow their pulls, their callings, and we call this body radar. You let the body tell you where it wants to go, and you give it the chance to do so. And you're doing that for, you know, what feels like an eternity sometimes. I'm not kidding. And all of a sudden your alarm goes, dee, 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 and you're like, whoa. And you're looking, you're like, whoa, that was only 15 minutes. It felt really expansive. You know, because sense of time shifts when you drop into wandering and you start to realize that there's other dimensionalities of experiencing reality. But because our brain gets used to a certain rhythm of time measurement, we actually shut ourselves off from that possibility of expansiveness. You know, so give yourself the gift of timelessness and utilize timelessness and utilize wandering. Let the body pull you to where it wants to go and give it the space to do so multiple times a day, and then try to land on that same chair, that same stoop, and start to really expand out into one place and see where that takes you. You know, these are all things that we've evolved with a lot of time and feedback with thousands of people around the world now, tens of thousands, and these things really work. These are actually modern aids for healing the lack of timelessness and the lack of wandering. So, that's it.